greatest tool ever devised for understanding how the world works.
Science is a vacuum for knowledge. We are always at the brink of the node.
Science is a collaborative enterprise spanning the generations. We remember those who prepared the way, seeing through them also.
If you're scientifically literate, the world looks very different to you. And that understanding empowers you.
Welcome to Evolutionize Your Life. This is Michael Dowd.
And Connie Barlow. And this is session one called Your Larger Story, Big History and the Power of an Evolutionary Worldview.
Yeah, we'd like to take just a few moments here and just give you the big picture, both in general, but also of this course. This first week, we're going to be covering sort of the evolutionary context, our bigger story, our larger common creation story, humanity's creation story that we now know through science.
So there we're going to get the overview of looking beyond ourselves for a story that really is our story too, before we delve down into our own personal lives, our physical, relational, and other challenges we may have for the simple reason that we have Stone Age instincts and we're living in a modern world.
And so the other 4 weeks really deal with our brain and our instincts. Week two, our physical instincts, basically our reptilian brain's hunger for safety, sustenance, and sex. Week three, our social instincts, our old mammalian brain's longing for bonding, status, and play. Week four, our interpretive instincts, our neocortex's drive for meaning, morality, and making sense. And then the fifth week, our co-creative instincts, our prefrontal cortex's zeal for wholeness, transcendence, and contribution.
And from an evolutionary perspective, these 4 weeks, the physical instincts, and then the social instincts, and then the interpretive instincts, and finally the co-creative instincts, it mirrors the way our brains actually evolved over the course of millions of years in our ancestors.
So over the course of the next hour or so, what we'll be doing, actually a variety of things. Connie, why don't you speak to it?
Yeah. What we're going to be doing is introducing you to a way of learning in which this particular teaching session here is pretty much a way of guiding your way through. We're going to give you some of the main content, certainly the benefits that we're hoping that you'll be able to bring out within yourself as you move through this session, and then the online resources and the practices. So there's really three components to this first week, as there will be for every week, and that is the overall context and direction that you'll be hearing here, the practices and exercises that help you take it deeply into your life, and the online resources where the content and the possibilities for transformation are fully fleshed out.
I'd like to say at the very start that in order to get the most out of this course, it really is going to require you to not just listen to these sessions, but also to do the practices or exercises, and also to really take a look at the resources, to listen to what we're suggesting, to watch what we're suggesting, to read what we're suggesting. We're not giving you a lot. It's not an overwhelming amount, although we will point those people who have a lot of time on their hands and really want to go deeper, we'll show you how to do that. But sort of the core resources that we suggest, we really do invite you to take the time, to make the time, carve out the time, because you will really benefit as a result of it, we promise.
And we've made sure that those core resources are fun. I mean, we have entered an age now where many of us are moving away from text ways of learning and more towards audio and video ways of learning. So you're going to see a lot of resources that are video ways of learning online, others that are audio, and some text as well for those of you who want to do that.
Said another way, we'll have YouTube clips, we'll have podcasts, we'll have blog posts, a variety of things.
And again, we think that once you start delving into these resources, you're basically not going to be able to stop.
At least that's our intention.
I know. They'll lead you places and you'll just be going, wow and wow. I mean, what these resources are, some of which I've created in both audio and video form and collages of other things. What these are is the amalgam of what for Michael, me, and other people in this epic of evolution, universe story, big history movement over the years have found awesome. And we're giving them all to you in week one. So, I mean, get ready to have your brains just blown out. I mean, I can't even imagine what it would have been like had I encountered all this stuff all at once.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know.
Yeah. So again, the title of this first session is Your Larger Story, Big History, and the Power of an Evolutionary Worldview. So let me take just a moment and talk about big history. Over the course of the last 25, 30 years or so, a number of different terms have been used for the universe story or the epic of evolution, our physical, biological, and social history. That is the history of everyone and everything. And it's now going by the academic term big history. In other words, it's the history of everyone and everything. It's basically the whole shebang from the beginning of the universe till this moment, our best evidential understanding of that.
And we imagine that quite a few of you on this course are already familiar with the great story, the epic of evolution, the universe story. Perhaps you've encountered it through Brian Swim's writings or Thomas Berry's writings or Ursula Goodenough's work in her Sacred Depths of Nature. There's just a lot of people who've been contributing to this. But what's happened over the last just couple of years is finally this has penetrated academia.
In other words, there's courses being taught all over the world now in big history, in this epic of evolution. And it's a really exciting time because this really is humanity's common creation story. And the reason why it's so important, or one of the reasons why it's so important, is it really helps us know who we are, where we are in time and space, who we're related to, what are the patterns, the trends that have been at work, sometimes millions or billions of years old trends. And so it gives us realistic hope, hope grounded in a factual understanding of reality so that we can see our lives in a more meaningful way. It can engage us to be in action in our world and to be of service to the world in more empowered ways. It can help make sense of chaos and difficulties and challenges. It's just, that's what a cosmology does. That's what a worldview does. And we now have one that can unite all of us as a species. It doesn't divide us as traditional worldviews have. It unites us all. And it does so not at the expense of the traditional stories. It actually brings them all together.
So what we're going to be doing first is introducing you to the person who named Big History. This is David Christian. He's an Australian. He's also taught in the United States for a while. But he's the one whose venture into this understanding of the 13.7 billion year universe, where all scientific and historical and cultural disciplines are brought together and patterns are shown to the student. And students are then asked to find themselves within these patterns and to see that they're part of a grand journey. He's really the first one who's been moving it worldwide with other professors that he's working with. And there's a very significant thing that happened just over the past 2 years.
Yeah, it's been very exciting. He did a teaching company course that's been one of their best courses, and Bill Gates got turned on to it, and then he was invited to do a TED Talk, and Al Gore got excited about that, and I just got an email from David Christian actually this morning saying that he was being invited to Boston for a group of leaders to talk about what the world, the challenges that the world will be dealing with in the next 50 years. So it's a terribly exciting time. I first got a chance, in fact, Connie and I both got a chance to meet David for the first time 6 years ago. We organized a evolutionary salon, we had about 38 of the world's leading evolutionary thinkers that came together, and we spent 4 days together and just talked and just really got into stuff. And David was one of the people that we invited for that. But anyway, here we're going to let David speak in his own words. Connie and I interviewed him recently, and you can hear some of his excitement about this topic.
Big History is an attempt to grasp as a sort of single scientifically based story the history of the entire universe, and by doing that to understand how we and our planet fit into that story. So it's very much like an origin story. It has all the power of an origin story. But the great difference is that the rules are scientific. We accept all the rules of modern science. So the story is evidence-based, it's rigorous, and it's subject to change as new evidence kicks in. The way I got to Big History was just asking questions about what I felt students needed to know. I taught Russian history, which was great, but I always had this nagging feeling that they didn't need to know just about Russia. They needed to know about about humanity. So could you teach the history of humanity? And then once I started thinking about that, I thought, well, to do that, you have to talk about evolution, how humans were created. And to do that, you have to talk about the history of the Earth. And then very quickly, that took me back to the idea of a history of everything. And at first, given the way that education is constructed these days, the idea sounded completely lunatic. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought, wouldn't it be fun to try a history of everything? You know, it might be a bit of a mess, but let's try it. And so my colleagues, God bless them, at Macquarie University in Sydney, allowed me to try it, and not just in a sort of little graduate course where if it was a disaster, it wouldn't matter, but actually in a big first-year course. We were feeling our way for several years. But what was wonderful was that the students, presented with a course that tried to teach the history of everything, beginning with the origins of the universe, describing the creation of stars, the creation of galaxies, the creation of the solar system, of the Earth, the evolution of life on Earth, and the appearance of humans, and then teaching human history in that context. The students loved it, even if we couldn't give them terribly clear answers. I think what they loved was that at a university, these big, big questions, which are questions about your place in the universe and the meaning of life and the meaning of everything, they're questions every kid should be asking. Finally, a university course was validating the questions.
Yes.
And I think that was the important thing. You know, whether or not the answers we gave were the best, I'm a historian, so, you know, I'm pretty sure some of the things I said about biology were not that precise. But the students, I think, just loved the questions. And that's what kept us going, is realizing how exciting it was, not just for the students, for us as well as teachers, to try to think this through. And now I've been doing this for, gosh, it's almost 22 years. And I still find it exciting, trying to use the vast amount of information that's been generated by modern scientific scholarship in field after field after field, including history, to put together a coherent kind of universal story. By the way, at the Big History Project website, there's a nice little sort of cartoon introduction to Big History, which is worth looking at.
Okay.
And that sort of explains how I got to Big History.
So that clip you just heard of a conversation that Michael and I had on Skype just a few weeks ago with David Christian was because we had just discovered that David Christian had done a TED Talk. Those of you who may not know what TED Talks are, just Google TED, T-E-D, Talks, and you'll find them on YouTube. It's a fabulous way to learn.
There's some of the most exciting teachers and thinkers in our world presenting to some of the most influential people in our world.
So we'd like to play for you now a clip of just the audio of a few minutes taken from his 18-minute TED Talk, but you're going to want to see it. We'll assign it to you in the resources. You'll be able to click right on it and get to it, because Bill Gates is thoroughly excited by this.
In fact, as I mentioned in our preview call to this course, if you just put into Google Bill Gates Big History, you'll see what Bill Gates is saying about David's Big History course and why he's working with them to create a curriculum for high school students all over the world, a free curriculum. This is very exciting. So here's David Christian in his TED Talk.
So here's a great puzzle. In a universe ruled by the second law of thermodynamics, how is it possible to generate the sort of complexity I've described, the sort of complexity represented by you and me and the convention center? Well, the answer seems to be the universe can create complexity, but with great difficulty. In pockets, there appear what my colleague Fred Speer calls Goldilocks conditions, not too hot, not too cold, just right for the creation of complexity. And slightly more complex things appear. And where you have slightly more complex things, you can get slightly more complex things. And in this way, complexity builds stage by stage. Each stage is magical because it creates the impression of something utterly new, appearing almost out of nowhere in the universe. We refer in Big History to these moments as threshold moments. And at each threshold, the going gets tougher. The complex things get more fragile, more vulnerable. The Goldilocks conditions get more stringent, and it's more difficult to create complexity. Now, we as extremely complex creatures desperately need to know this story of how the universe creates complexity despite the second law, and why complexity means vulnerability and fragility. And that's the story that we tell in big history. But to do it, you have to do something that may at first sight seem completely impossible. You have to survey the whole history of the universe. So let's do it. Let's begin by winding the timeline back 13.7 billion years to the beginning of time.
Amen, David. Let's do it. So that's what Connie and I want to do this week, is really give you the tools. We want you to spend a lot of time on one of the resources, which is the Great Story page. What is the Great Story? Because you'll just follow your heart. Just watch or listen or read anything you want on that page. And just notice what happens, especially when you just sometimes close your eyes and just stop and allow yourself to feel what it is that you just listened to, or what it is that you just watched, or what it is that you just read. So that's what we'd like to speak to a little bit more now, is what is this big story? What is this larger context? And why is it important?
And why is it important? Throughout the audio of this session, we're going to be piecing in three more clips of three people who are massively involved in this epic of evolution, great story, big history movement, who are going to be telling you their personal stories of how they awakened to this and what it's done in their lives. And so Michael and I are going to start off with our stories as well, because that's the reason we're doing this. Michael and I have each been involved in this understanding for about 20 years, but why is it? I mean, why is it that we're doing this? I mean, what motivated us to feel that this is our great work, that here we take all our experience, all the skills that we've developed in other ways, doing other careers over the years, and why is this where we're putting our energy now? As some of you know, we've been on the road for 9 years bringing this evolutionary understanding into churches and secular audiences and colleges all over the USA and in some parts of Canada, and it is our calling. Since the mid-1980s, I began preparing myself to become a science writer, following my avocational bliss in just reading wonderful science texts and the history of evolutionary biology and the history and philosophy of science, and finally then preparing myself to take it back into the world. So I've written 4 popular science books in evolutionary biology and what meaning it can give us in the world. Plus, I've been an editor in science, and I've helped other writers write books in popular science. But this understanding of evolution didn't really impinge on my personal life in a big way until I took in the deep time understanding of the role of chaos in the world. For the previous decade or so, my primary non-career interest of just moving out into the world had been as an environmental activist while I was living in Alaska, working on creating national parks in that state, wilderness designations. I was an avid kayaker. But I got very depressed, as many in my generation had, about all the losses that we were experiencing there in that great part of the world. And it wasn't until I really took in an evolutionary understanding, the long-term perspective, that I understood no matter how great our loss is in this moment, that Earth, a million years from now, if necessary, will be able to recreate the richness that we humans might take out. And that was vital. That was vital. I didn't burn out from then after, because if losses occurred, I took this deep time perspective, I just breathed into it, and I said, what matters is for me to be in action. It doesn't matter so much whether my actions are actually going to end up saving the planet, as I felt I wanted to do in my 20s. So that was really the first step. I'd say the second step came when I experienced the writings of Thomas Berry and also Brian Swim, but primarily Thomas Berry, where I heard for the very first time that it wasn't just for me as an environmental activist that this evolutionary perspective was useful, but it was also for me as someone, as a human being, someone who loved poetry, someone who loved art, someone who loved music and stories. Thomas Berry said that We're not just the knowers of the universe story. We're not just learning about the deep time past so that we can become better co-inhabitants of this planet. But we are actually the universe becoming aware of itself. Our role is actually not just to know, but to celebrate this universe story, that it's through us that the universe, in a way, is marveling at and learning and celebrating its own story. And that took a while to come into me. You're going to hear a clip a little bit later of someone who's one of the great artists in this movement, whose work has also brought that more into me. So the phase I'm in now is continuing to bring this to an adult level, as I always have. I've been spending more and more time of trying to influence how this story can be brought to children. Now, obviously, the Discovery Channel and the History Channel and NOVA programs are doing a great job with the science. But again, until the patterns can be brought out, until children can see themselves within this big picture, this deep time evolutionary understanding is still giving me a larger context for being able to continue work as an environmental activist. I'm still involved, this time working on global warming issues. And it really gives me a way to be able to be fully engaged, fully committed, but unattached to the results. And that's been a tremendous boon to myself, just in terms of feeling good about what I'm doing, but not going into crisis mode. Now, there are other aspects of this evolutionary story that have profoundly benefited me in my personal life, but I'm going to talk about those in a later episode, because that has to do with understanding the evolutionary history, the ancestry of my brain, and how I do still have Stone Age instincts, and so do the people I love. But for now, in this session, we're talking about the larger story, taking on the sense that I have a larger story, a larger sense of who I am.
I want to jump in just for a second and speak about why a larger story is even important. It's like if you were to wake up one morning and you didn't know your story, we call it amnesia, much more is lost than just your memory. Your sense of identity, your sense of who you're related to. I mean, your entire life would essentially collapse in terms of the meaning, the values, what gives you hope, what gives you inspiration, what makes you feel bonded and connected and everything else. And there's almost nothing worse than amnesia, other than perhaps severe brain damage. But in a way, amnesia is that. And we as a species have been suffering from amnesia. We haven't known who we are, and now we do. And so that's why this larger context makes a difference and can make a profound difference. Because for those of us that are religious, it allows us to reframe and to reinterpret and to deepen our own understanding of our religious tradition. But for people who are not religious in any way, shape, or form, what it does is it gives us a larger inspirational context and inspires us to work together so that we can co-create a healthy future for humanity and the larger body of life.
And as we'll be talking about later in this course, it is vital for being able to help us all shape our priorities.
So let me share a little of my personal story. My story, in a nutshell, is that I grew up Roman Catholic and then had a born-again experience in my late teenage years. I struggled a lot with drug and alcohol issues and was involved in a very Pentecostal fundamentalist context. Totally opposed to evolution. I was threatened by evolution. I read the Bible straight through twice. I interpreted it literally. I believed that evolution was of the devil and all the evils of the world could be attributed to Darwin. I mean, I was about as opposed to evolution as anybody can get. And my own on the road to Damascus type experience came as a student at Evangel College, and I had this profound experience where the teacher held up the textbook that we were going to use, and it taught evolution. And I just freaked, and I walked out of class, and I withdrew from the course, and I made a big deal. But I ended up embracing evolution. I ended up accepting it there at college, and then in 1988 was introduced to the work of Thomas Berry, and that's when I really got that humans are not separate from nature, that we're an expression of nature, that the universe has been expanding and unfolding for billions of years. And then in this solar system, the universe became complex enough that it could begin to understand its own nature, and that that's who we are. Humans are literally the universe, after some 14 billion years of unbroken evolution, now becoming conscious of itself. We are literally the universe becoming aware of itself. And we don't believe that, we know that. 99% of the scientists of the world would agree with what I just said. And that sense that we are nature uncovering its own nature, that we are the universe becoming aware of itself, is a profound shift of identity. My sense of self expanded instantaneously. It no longer stopped with my skin. And I realized I was related to all creatures. And so now I have this profound sense of belonging, this sense of relatedness. And I also have this guidance. It's not just my guidance in terms of what my parents taught me, but there's billions of years of wisdom in my very genes that guide me and that can guide all of us. And that's where we tap into this deep wisdom at the heart of the entire universe process.
So that's the whole purpose of this first session, is to see if you too might start thinking of your story as being larger than your personal story, larger than the story of your particular ancestry, larger than the story of your nation. Actually being able to go back in time and then be able to take from that story dynamics, understandings that you take into your own life and apply it in a way that has you be able to deal with life's inevitable difficulties in ways that give you more strength, give you more wisdom in how you react. So at this point, we're going to play for you a couple clips from recent interviews that we've done with people, actually conversations that Michael was doing as part of his Evolutionary Christianity series, where he specifically was asking people, how did you awaken to this evolutionary understanding as being something other than just science, but being something that actually fed you spiritually, being something that actually transformed your life in ways that you're grateful for now?
So we're going to begin with a clip from Reverend Bruce Sanguin, who pastors a church up in Vancouver, Canada. And he's a leader in integral Christianity. He's got a real passion for evolution, evolutionary spirituality, evolutionary Christianity, and integral philosophy. And you'll hear how he awakened to this universe story.
He's also a great author and a poet. His most recent book, If Darwin Prayed, is full of poetry that I, as a religious naturalist, a non-theistic person, it makes me cry. I mean, there's something about what he does that can bring secular and religious people together under one roof.
I remember I ended up in seminary, and I was had this wonderful New Testament professor who looked at me, I felt, every time the class ended and pointed to his temple and said, think, think, think. Because he was dealing with a lot of us kind of evangelicals or fundamentalists coming through. And so it took me about a year and a half, 2 years to realize that I could no longer embrace that kind of literalist interpretation of Scripture. The foundation collapsed for me. And the alternative to that was what, you know, kind of being in a liberal seminary was a kind of, you know, what we'd call a liberal theology, and nowadays we're calling a progressive theology, a progressive worldview, which, you know, on the one hand was great, but on the other hand, something was missing for me. And I think that over time, over a period of 5 to 10 years, I lost a sense of conviction, a sense of passion for the faith, because part of this, you know, liberal postmodern perspective has to do with everything being about context and perspective and there being no truth. What the integral folks call the myth of the framework. Everything is the framework, but there's no substance, there's no truth within it. It's all just a constructed narrative. And I found that I actually got to a place, I was actually ordained and serving my second congregation when I just felt like I was wandering in a desert and my faith had no juice. And I was trying to preach Sunday after Sunday and just had lost the passion. And so I ended up going to a silent retreat in Narragansett, Rhode Island, a 10-day retreat, and had this mystical experience of being one with the cosmos, being an expression of the cosmos, a manifestation of the cosmos after 13.7 billion years, and experienced a kind of radical connectedness and a kinship with all that is, including what I was, you know, what I'd call spirit or God. So I kind of staggered around the seashore for 4 days in this state. Kind of my mantra was, I am the universe noticing the universe. I am the universe feeling the universe.
How did that come to you? Like,
well, it came to me. The reason it came to me, I don't know if I've ever shared the story with you, was that I, on the silent retreat, I picked up Brian Swim's slim volume, The Universe is a Green Dragon.
Oh, sure.
You know, I read it in one sitting.
Yep, yep.
And I got it. It just was like, oh my goodness. This, where, like, what cosmos have I been inhabiting?
Yes.
Where have I been? Who did I think I was? If I am not this, if I am not the presence of the universe in this human form in the 24, then who do I think I am? This little, you know, bag of, I mean, partly this bag of skin and bones, but what happened was that the dualistic worldview collapsed.
Yes.
In other words, there's Bruce over here. And the universe is out there. It's something I look at up in the sky somehow. Or, you know, there's the Earth, and then there's Bruce, and I'm walking on it. But the experience was that I was walking as the Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
As the presence of the Earth in human form. And as I say, this was an experience of enlightenment for me. It was no less than enlightenment.
Yeah.
And in important ways, it was different than the classical Eastern form of enlightenment, which basically is kind of an escape from the wheel of life. This was more an evolutionary form of enlightenment, a kind of a Western form of enlightenment, where I realized that I was the presence of the universe after 13.7 billion years, and we all were, and that therefore my essential vocation was to, or is to, ask myself the question, what is the future that needs me in order to emerge?
Yeah, well, great.
Right? So that kind of shifted everything for me. And to come full circle in terms of it, it gave me a reason to be in ministry again.
Mm-hmm.
Because I regained the passion and the conviction that's required to stand up Sunday after Sunday and do what I do.
Yeah.
So that was Bruce Sangwin. Bruce has become a dear friend and colleague of both of ours, and we view him to be one of the leaders in this movement. We're going to play for you now one more clip of how someone who's prominent in this movement, this Epic of Evolution movement, awakened to the universe story. The funny thing is it was the same book as Bruce Sangwin mentioned. But as you listen to this, listen as well to what it's done for her and how she's taken it into her life, how she's now taken the dynamics that she sees expressed outwardly in the universe story, and sees that those very same dynamics are ongoing in her. This is Mary Southard. She's a sister of St. Joseph in Illinois, and for several decades, she's been the painter and the sculptor that many of us go to as having the expression artistically, visually, of this universe story and our place within it. Mary Southard.
It's quite a journey. I would have to say I first met Brian Swim's writing when one of our high school religion classes was reading The Universe is a Green Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher there gave a copy to all of the science teachers, and one of them is one of my good friends. And she was reading it, and she said, Mary, you've got to read this. You'll love it. And so I was reading The Universe is a Green Dragon, and the wonderful thing I think that began to happen there was that I'd always been, you might say, able or invited into catching the vibes of the Earth. I always sensed a real kinship and and presence. But reading about the wind and the sun and so on, I began to experience myself. I couldn't have said it then, but I can say it now. I think that was the beginning of experiencing myself as Earth, not separate from Earth.
Yeah.
And that the dynamics of creation are the same dynamics that are going on in me and growing me and alluring me, et cetera, et cetera. So it was then in 88, a few years later, that I really faced the bad news. And so I would say that as I was reading everything in sight, which I tend to do, and practicing believing that I'm part of the Earth, the year after Thomas Berry, that summer, the one thing I wanted to do, which I had wanted to do all my life, was to live on the land. And I was able to live on a farm, in an old farmhouse by myself for a year. And the whole story of creation was so magnificent. And the bad news was so bad. And what I felt myself called to do, to participate in this great work, in this project of creation, of evolution, was so beyond me that I decided the best thing I could do was, as soon as I woke up in the morning, I'd pull on my boots and my parka and so on, and I went out and stood on the earth. Just to remind myself of the, in those days they were talking about 15 to 8 billion, 18 billion years of creative energy which is flowing through me now. That it's not me that has to do anything, but I need to allow it to be done through me. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah.
So there I would be standing on the top of the hill. And that practice was a wonderful practice. I can see why our indigenous people begin the day that way. It's like remembering who I am.
Yes, exactly.
That I am the earth. And at the same time, I thought to myself, well, the way we're going to wake up and change the way we're doing things is we have to fall in love again with the earth. Mm-hmm. So I was working on that calendar. That was, I can't remember the year, 19. Anyway, it's Let's Fall in Love Again. And I think there's a kind of an insight there that's really true, that we'll protect what we love. And I was teaching a course at Loyola one day a week called Self, Symbol, and Integration. But after the summer with Thomas Berry's thought and so on, I said to the director of the program there, the master's program, at the Institute for Pastoral Studies, I said, but I have to teach a different course. I'd love to teach again, but I have to teach something else. Mm. And so I taught the universe story, our story.
Wow.
It was a wonderful experience because I told the class at the beginning that there were only two books available or three books at that moment. And so that was The Dream of the Earth, Thomas Berry, mm-hmm. and Universe is a Green Dragon, and they didn't know where to put them, in libraries or in bookstores.
Right.
So I said, this is so new that we're going to create this course together. There's a sense of direction, but actually we kind of practiced evolution. That was the greatest thing that helped me to trust my intuitions. And oftentimes I wonder, what would it be like if we could really trust that we have the wisdom of 13.7 billion years of evolution within us, that we have these dynamics, that we can rely on that creative energy, that fire that's within us since the fireball.
Oh, preach it, sister.
Okay. So those are the kind of questions I walk around with, you know, and how can we be a part of it? We can't do everything because there's so much to be done. And I think that kind of overwhelms people.
Yes.
If we're going to be able to let the truth in, we have to also have a sense of how we can live with that truth. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we'll be so overwhelmed. And sometimes we feel guilty to start with. Well, it's all our fault. Well, that doesn't help. You know, we didn't do it on purpose. But now, how can we creatively participate in creating alternative ways of being in relationship with the planet?
Exactly. One of the great opportunities of our time is to not only tell the story, but for the artists, the musicians, the storytellers, the poets, the sculptors, all the people who can take the various forms of artistic expression and find ways of embodying this great story in those things.
You're reminding me of something else I'd like to talk about a little bit, and that is the importance of the arts in this time of transformation, because it's a way of learning the story or being present to the story or being able to experience the implications of this amazing time that we're in at a level that's deeper than our verbal Homo sapiens can grasp it. We have so many more levels of consciousness that are deeper than thought that we're just beginning to discover and to access. And I think the arts invite us to go there and be able to receive the mysteries that are really beyond thought, beyond realization. Like one of the questions I asked, mentioned earlier, what does it mean to be the earth? You know, what does it mean that I have within my cellular reality all of these operations and dynamics that are going on, digesting my lunch and breathing and so on, and how intimate the universe is. You know, sometimes we think of the universe as being so huge, which it is, but it's also more intimate than we ever imagined. So how can the arts bring us to that? Some of the best stories actually are coming out in film. That's a medium that speaks to people today. Poetry more and more certainly is. It allows us to go a little bit deeper than the head.
It also engages our feelings. It engages our emotions.
Of course, and our hearts.
Yep.
Yeah.
Mary's great. This leads us to want to talk about our first exercise, our first practice. We invite you to reflect on the stories of awakening told by both Bruce Sangwin and Mary Southard in this session here, and also to watch the music videos recommended in the resource tab for the first course module, and then also to read my blog post, 7 Big Picture or Great Story Affirmations. It's just one page. And then choose to memorize one affirmation, either one of the ones offered there or create one of your own, but something that really speaks to the truth of our nature as you now understand it, and actually repeat it over and over again. I've memorized a dozen of them, but just take one, 2 at the most. And so that's the first practice or exercise, is something that's just been shared or one of the ones that you read that I have or one of your own. And to really internalize, not just memorize it, but to internalize it, to maybe go outside and lay down or look at the stars or look at the trees or whatever, and just allow yourself to really feel it.
Remember in Bruce Sangwin's audio excerpt there, he talks about how wandering around on the beach after he had his experience of realizing who he really was, he got his larger story, he got his larger self, what Thomas Berry calls the great self. And he invented a mantra right there, an affirmation. I am the universe perceiving the universe. I'm the universe feeling the universe. And so, again, for the people that we've just interviewed, Michael's and my story, it's come to us not because we've been told to try to do it. It's been our life circumstances. But here we're offering you an opportunity to take the lead from these people and see if you too might have a transformation. And then, of course, please do use the community forum to report on what, if anything, came to you as a result of this practice of cognitively taking in, based on what we're saying now, what you're hearing, going to the resources, and then starting to perceive the world when you go out into it, and then see if it goes even deeper to affecting your identity of who you are, and perhaps even Mary Southard's experience of not just affecting her identity of who she is, but realizing that the very dynamics of the universe are also being expressed through her. And Michael, why don't you mention something about one of the key understandings is this understanding that chaos leads to creativity, which then allows us to trust the process outside us and inside us.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that we now know through a whole range of sciences is that the primary catalyst for creativity, like the main thing that for billions of years has brought about emergent creativity, new things, new possibilities, new opportunities, is chaos. That it turns out that chaos, breakdowns, destruction is the most important thing in catalyzing creativity. And I talk about that. One of the other resources that we'll invite you to that we'll mention a little bit later more is chapter 2 in my book, Thank God for Evolution, is up online. It's actually a sermon that I wrote for non-Christian audiences, but it actually applies to everybody. And it's called Evolution and the Revival of the Human Spirit. And please do take time to read that, because that's going to give you a lot of the content that Mary Southard is talking about and Bruce Tsang was talking about and what Connie and I have been talking about, and also the essential role. I give a lot of examples there of how chaos and breakdowns and destruction and violence have been absolutely essential to catalyzing creativity, and how that can build faith, how that can build trust within ourselves for the chaos that we deal with in our own lives and in our culture.
So Michael just mentioned the first practice and exercise for you to do after you've listened to this audio and after you've experienced several of the resources that we're recommending. And then practice two we're suggesting for this first week is actually quite simple. It's adopting a favorite quotation. Now, perhaps for many of you, as it has been for me, I occasionally am so affected by a piece of poetry or something prose that someone has written that I make a practice of actually taking it in a way where I can recite it to myself. Michael and I have also been in a career position recently where it's been useful to do that. We give so many talks that we love to be able to recite extemporaneously in front of an audience one of our favorite quotations or pieces of poetry to illustrate a point. So over the past 10 years, just before Michael and I launched this journey of living a life entirely on the road, I realized that it was important to have a website. And this was very early in the days of learning websites. And so I initiated what's now called thegreatstory.org. And on that website, I have a page where I've been collecting quotations. Some of these great quotations, people like Mary Southard, Charles Darwin, Thomas Berry, Brian Swim, what are these inspiring short quotations that people have said about who we are in the universe story and what this means to us? So you'll see in the practice adopting a favorite quotation, I send you to three different pages for you to go through and just see which of all these quotations speaks to you. Choose one, post it on the community forum so you can let other people in this course know what your favorite quotation is. Maybe say something about what it was about it that inspired you, and then see what others are saying on their favorite quotations. And then take some time to memorize it. Take it into your life.
Just to let you know how I've done that is that I've, whenever there's been a quote that I've wanted to learn or an affirmation that I've wanted to memorize and rehearse, I actually write it down on a piece of paper. I find that handwriting rather than typing is useful for me. And then I just carry it around as a piece of paper. And when I, you know, mow the grass or drive somewhere or, you know, walk and do the dishes or whatever, I just kind of glance at it a few times and I try to memorize it. And it usually doesn't take very long. It can actually happen pretty quickly. And if you have real difficulty, just take a really short one. Like, for example, my favorite short quotation, it's literally one of my favorite quotes in the world, is from Carl Sagan. It's just real simple, one line. Science is at least in part informed worship. Science is at least in part informed worship. So it doesn't have to be a long quote.
That's great, Michael.
So let's just take a quick walk through the resources.
Now, we're not going to overwhelm you with resources. And in fact, one of the things that we're really excited about having our first opportunity to do an actual online course is that we can have video, audio, and text. And quite frankly, because I'm more of an audio-video person, even though I've written four books, I just love taking things in a more personal sort of way. So you're mostly going to find audio and video resources available to you, but there's also going to be several texts that we have. For this first module, module one on your larger self, we've got five resources that we're not just recommending. We really, really want you to go through these. It should take no more than during the week, an hour and a half to 2 hours of your time, though of course you can go much deeper. As you know, once you get on the internet, one thing leads to another. But these are the ones that we'd love to have everybody participating in this go through. And then as you're so moved, comment on it. Tell the others of what you experienced about it or where you're feeling challenged. So the first one, it's a web page, again, that I've been assembling on the greatstory.org website for about 10 years. And it's called, What is the Great Story? And it looks like a single resource, but once you click on it, just kind of scroll down the whole thing. You'll see embedded videos, you'll see audios. This is where we're giving people what we consider to be available online, the best short introductions from a variety of people's perspectives of what this big history understanding is about.
And on that webpage, you're going to see a ton of great stuff. Just follow your heart. Just follow your heart. The next resource is an audio. It's Connie and I talking on one of the podcasts that we've done called Humanity's Rite of Passage into Adulthood. It's about a half hour, and it's a really excellent overview. Now, I must warn you, we just listened to it the other day, and the content is fabulous, although at one point I remember thinking to myself, well, I sound a little manic at points. I wish I'd have slowed down just a little bit. So please forgive me for perhaps speaking a bit too fast in a couple of places.
Michael, you actually, 3 weeks later, you really slowed down because that's when you got your cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
And in fact, the historical perspective is important here. And that's it when you're going through the, Michael talked about the third online resource, Evolution and the Revival of the Human Spirit, that Michael already talked about. It's about 8 pages in length. And as I was going through that a couple days ago, I realized that there was a metaphor that Michael used that given recent events, he probably wouldn't use anymore. And again, this was written in 2002, and he talks about, playfully, he says, so the next time a 300-foot tsunami comes your way, I mean, we've just had the Japan tsunami that happened, and then, of course, in 2004 was the Indonesian tsunami that happened. But again, Michael was talking from a deep time perspective about what happened when the meteor hit 65 million years ago and wiped out the dinosaurs. Chaos, breakdown, terrible. But again,
and tsunamis.
And tsunamis, much bigger than anything that's ever been experienced by humankind.
And finally, we have two music videos that that we highly recommend.
They're each about 4 minutes long. And if you go to the YouTube pages for these videos, you'll see that some people have had quite transformative experiences just watching them. The first one is called The Play by the singer-songwriter Peter Mayer. Now, Peter Mayer is my favorite singer-songwriter, and he does quite a bit in this Epic of Evolution movement. And it's actually a music video that I created. So I love collaborating with Peter Mayer, and I got a chance to use some of the photographs that I've been taking on our journey throughout North America. So Michael, could you talk about the second music video?
The second music video is called We Are All Connected by Symphony of Science. Young man John Boswell has put together various scientists and some of the leading scientists and science popularizers, and he has them using auto-tune. He has them singing their words. So what Carl Sagan actually said in Cosmos, here he sings, and millions of young people are being turned on to science in a sacred way, in a meaningful way, as a result of these Symphony of Science music videos. So we're really excited about them for that reason, and we've actually now listened to them a lot, and we love them.
when this particular one came out, We Are All Connected. It was John Boswell's second one, which he started in 2009, this whole series, just after graduating college. When I heard this one, I put it on my iPod. And I remember one afternoon, it was in the fall, one afternoon I was outside gardening for our host, trimming the lavender. And I put on my iPod play over and over and over again the audio of this particular music video. The music really speaks to me. The content speaks to me. And hope you enjoy it too. Oh, incidentally, the lead-in and what you'll hear the exit music here comes from another Symphony of Science piece that the young John Boswell has created called Poetry of Reality.
That'll be our theme music for this series.
So there's two more components that we'd like to give you in this session one audio. The first is an exploration of what can go wrong when we learn the science of big history or the science of the universe story, and we're not at the same time given an opportunity to reflect on possibilities for meaning. What can go wrong? Well, personally, I know what can go wrong. I see it all the time. One of the most poignant experiences I had, and this happened about 5 years ago when I was doing a religious education program for middle schoolers in a church in Wisconsin, is I began by asking them, tell me some examples of creation stories around the world. That is, these kids were getting a very good education in sort of world religions. And they were also given an education in understanding the Native American, the indigenous creation stories. A couple of them were able to point out Greek myths. And of course, they knew the Garden of Eden story in Genesis. And so they were great. They knew some creation stories. And then I stopped and I looked at them and I said, what's your creation story? What's your creation story? Not a single hand went up. So I started walking the room and I said, in the beginning, 13.7 billion years ago, what scientists call the Big Bang, what we call the Great Radiance, everything came into being. And at that point, one of the boys shot up his hand and he said, oh, that's what we're learning in science class. And yes, that's what kids are learning in science class on the Discovery Channel. But they don't recognize that it's their creation story. And this is where something can go deeply wrong.
One of the most important philosophers of religion and philosophers of evolution is Loyal Rue. And Loyal Rue has one of his earliest books is called Amythia, where he talks about the fact that we are the first culture in human history not to have a deeply meaningful, viable, believable myth that we all do in fact believe. And this notion of Amythia, that we are without a myth, that our culture is now without a unifying myth, really has as its roots an understanding of how collective intelligence has evolved. Human beings have always attempted to understand the nature of their world. In fact, there's two questions that are at the heart of every religion. What's real and what's important? What's real, or how things are, and what's important, or which things matter? And every religion, every philosophy, every culture has had that understanding. In other words, the best that they can discern what's real and what's important, and then how to live out of that, which is the question of what's wise. That is, in light of what's real and what's important, how do we live so that we are living in right relationship to reality? That is, so that we are living wisely. And what cultures provide when they've got a viable myth, when they've got a viable sacred story that answers these questions of what's real, what's important, and what's wise, is they have a story that results in two fundamental things: personal wholeness and social coherence. There's not a religion anywhere in the world that isn't a map of what's real and what's important, that if you align your life and your culture with that map, you'll experience personal wholeness and social coherence. But of course, reality keeps shifting. In other words, reality at the scale of a family or clan 50,000 years ago is not the same thing as reality at the scale of a tribe 20,000 years ago. Nor is reality at the scale of a tribe 20,000 years ago the same as reality in a Neolithic village 5,000 years ago. And so what happens is we keep finding ways of cooperating at larger and wider scale. This is the trajectory of big history in terms of its human expression. but we also keep finding that reality is different at each of these scales, and our collective intelligence about what's real and what's important keeps growing. In other words, collective intelligence at the scale of a tribe may not serve at the level of a chiefdom or a kingdom. And collective intelligence at the level of a chiefdom and kingdom may not serve at the level of a city-state or an early nation. And so that's what really science is. Science is now humanity's global collective intelligence, where for the first time we have a story that can unite us all, because the story itself is a story of what's real and what's important that actually has been generated globally. And we can move forward. It's only if we're operating on a map of reality that's accurately aligned with the nature of our best understanding of the nature of reality that we can move forward in a healthy way, because otherwise we're going to be having understandings of what's important that are based on outdated maps of what's real. And as I often say in my evening programs, it's not a surprise that America is not leading the world with regards to our response to climate change, because 1 in 3 Americans believe these are the end times anyway, so why bother? In other words, those are people that are operating on an ancient map of what's real. It's kind of like their inner GPS is way out of date, and so that their understanding of what's important is skewed. And so that's why we need evolving wisdom. We need to collective intelligence at the global scale.
And that's why we're emphasizing this larger story, a larger sense of self in this first session. So again, what can go wrong is when students are learning science, but it's not brought into the patterns of big history, into the meaning of evolution. They're still going to be amythic. They're going to see it as science, not as their larger story, not as an opportunity to develop a sense of a larger self. And of course, that can lead into an existential angst.
And so our final audio clip is from a dear friend and colleague, Ursula Goodenough, who is a religious naturalist. She's the author of The Sacred Depths of Nature.
And so in this final audio clip, we're going to give you an example of someone who talks not so much about her story of awakening, but her story as a young woman of falling into existential angst. The more signs she learned, the smaller she felt. So this is Ursula Goodenough. She's one of the leaders in the Epic of Evolution movement. Her 1998 book, Sacred Depths of Nature, I've heard many, many people feel that they've had an awakening to. She's a world-class cell biologist as well. So this is Ursula Goodenough.
I was on a camping trip, and I went out and slept under the stars somewhere in Colorado, I believe, and I looked up, and all of a sudden, all of the stuff that I'd been hearing in my physics course kind of swept over me in this chaotic way, and I realized I had no idea what the meaning of anything was or the meaning of my life and all of my little concerns and adolescent things were completely dwarfed by just this whole star thing. So instead of the star thing being something cute and kind of a little dome over my world, my whole world kind of fell apart. And so I felt very bummed out about it, tried not to think about it, and only slowly, and in particular during my work in the religious naturalism movement, when I went back, was to come to understand that it didn't have to be the case that I had everything all figured out and that my life was a big, important deal, that the whole emergence of the universe and its emergence in life and then emergence in me was something that I could just celebrate and not try to figure out some overriding purpose for it. Instead, I articulated what I've called a covenant with mystery, where if you really believe in mystery, then mystery is something that you don't even try to parse out. You don't even try to give it a name or give it properties. You just get into the mystery that there is this mystery, that there is everything. And that has become my ballast against these kinds of concerns and feelings of terror.
Well, you know, that leads me to want to ask you, when you think of the big picture, when you think of this epic of evolution and humans as an expression of the universe, not separate from the universe, where do you find sort of the core feeling states. And humans have always needed to thrive. Feeling states like trust when you look to the future, gratitude when you look to the past, inspiration in the moment to be in action, whatever the challenges or chaos of the day may bring. What is it that gives you trust, gratitude, and inspiration?
Well, that's a pretty big question. I think I could start by saying that there's a way that your question was something that the book that Connie mentioned, Sacred Depths of Nature, is about, in that I tell the story in 12 chapters quite briefly, and then at the end of each chapter, I have something that I called a reflection, mm-hmm. where it's really a meditation on a particular feeling state that particular feature of the epic elicits in me. So in each part of the book, I was able to access a response mode that fit with that particular part of the story. It was kind of fun working it out mechanically, just writer to writer,
yeah, sure.
to get it all to work. One of the things I didn't want to do was to have each chapter end with awe and wonder. I mean, that's kind sure. of, So I tried to have gratitude be something that I focused in a particular story. I can't remember which chapter
yes.
gratitude came in, but they all sort of fit. One of the key ones, going back to this freaking out at the universe kind of thing, that I think is important is something that I call ascent, A-S-S-E-N-T, where I see that as a very important traditional religion response as well, but that one gives one's assent to that which is, and the whole notion that this is the way the universe is. It's not like we're given a great big choice about it, and so rather than wish it were some other way, to go ahead and give one's assent to it, and once one does that, once one makes that move, then it's possible to access joy and celebration.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I first read your book, I remembered the language that I had used up to that point, and I still probably use most often, is making life right. But whether it's talked about as trust in the universe, saying yes to what's real, or celebrating reality, as you say, assent, it's choosing to say yes to reality as it really is, not just as we wish it was.
Right.
In that book, Sacred Depths of Nature, where you really give us an intimate look in your own journey and your own struggles. It's not an easy thing. And when you bring up the word ascent, there's a richness, there's a depth there that has an epiphany feel to it that's beyond good and bad, beyond feel good or feel bad. There's something huge about that word and that experience of giving your ascent when you really know how big and how old and in a way how indifferent the universe is.
I mean, I'm reminded of the Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyer conversation where they're talking about the sublime nature of reality, where Joseph Campbell says it's just saying yes
yeah.
to life just as it is.
I remember reading Ursula's Take on Ascent, and I remember that part. It was where Bill Moyer confronts Joseph Campbell on, but what about the suffering in the world? The Hindu story of needing to go into war even though you know that everyone's going to die and just participating in it. And Joseph Campbell gets a smile on his face, raises himself in the chair, and just says, isn't that sublime? And using that word, it's beyond good and evil, but it's just a sense of I don't know, it's got its own word that nothing else, ascent is it has no synonyms. It's just there. So anyway, Ursula,
I remember a skeptic friend of mine who read the book said he was going to write a sequel and he was going to call it The Dark Depths of Nature because he thought that I had painted it at all too sweetly.
So in this week or however long you're going to take to work through this first session, see if you too can come to the point of saying yes to the universe.
Just as it is.
So closing off with this first introduction, session one, what can go right? What can go right when we learn big history, the epic of evolution, and we really take it in? We move beyond any possibility for feeling ourselves small and insignificant and everything's horrible. What can we do when this larger self is something that we say yes to?
Well, for me, what it's done personally is it's profoundly enhanced my faith. Not faith as beliefs, but faith as trust. Because I know for a fact how essential chaos and breakdowns have been throughout the entire history of life, I trust the chaos and the breakdowns of my life. It allows me to be present to those things from a very, very different place. I also trust the challenges that I experience. I pretty much get in the habit now of asking myself, whenever things are tough or difficult, I ask myself, okay, here's what's real, now what's possible? And that question of, okay, here's what's real, now what's possible, keeps me in a place of expectancy. And I get that from this understanding of the universe. I also know myself as the universe. I don't lose the perspective that I am connected to all of life, that my larger body, my larger self, includes the planet, includes the Milky Way galaxy, and includes the entire universe.
And as we'll get to in the final and fifth session of this particular online course, that understanding of who we really are, our great self, our large self, is going to be absolutely vital when we contemplate our own death. So, Michael and I want to let you know that we are also going to be doing the practices during the week that we suggest for you to do. And so I'd like to read for you now a quote that I've selected. I've actually used it a lot. I present it a lot when I'm doing presentations, but I've never taken the time to memorize it. It's by Nancy Ellen Abrams, who's one of the authors of the 2006 book, The View from the Center of the Universe. And you'll see Nancy Ellen Abrams when you go to the top resource we're recommending, What is the Great Story webpage. Hers is the very first embedded video that you'll see there, and I actually created that video. Here's one of my favorite quotations from that 2006 book, View from the Center of the Universe. Without a meaningful, believable story that explains the world we actually live in, people have no idea how to think about the big picture. And without a big picture, we are very small people.
Now, I too will be learning a new quote this week, but here's a quote that I learned about 15 years ago, I memorized, and it's one of my favorites. It's the way that Thomas Berry, who's one of our great mentors, he just died about 2 years ago, and it's the way he ends chapter 10 of his book, The Dream of the Earth. It'll give you a sense of where I ground my faith, where I ground my trust. It goes like this. The basic mood of the future might well be one of confidence in the continuing revelation that takes place in and through the earth. The basic mood of the future might well be one of confidence in the continuing revelation that takes place in and through the earth. If the dynamics of the universe from the beginning shape the course of the heavens, light of the sun, and form the earth, if the same dynamism brought forth the continents and the seas and the atmosphere and awakened life in the primordial cell, and then brought into being the unnumbered variety of living beings, and then finally brought us into being and guided us safely through the turbulent centuries, there is reason to believe, good reason to believe, that this same guiding process is precisely what's awakened in us our present understanding of ourselves and our relation to this stupendous process. Sensitized to such guidance from the very structure and functioning of the universe, we can have confidence in the future that awaits the human venture.
So I'm looking forward to seeing which quotes you pick and post on the community forum. And Michael and I, we're going to both be in there. We're going to look forward to participating with you in this exploration.
And I'm sure the quote I picked for this week won't be nearly that long. So signing off, Michael Dowd.
And Connie Barlow.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
We can do science, and with it, we can improve our lives.
There's real poetry in the real world. Science is the poetry of reality.
The story of humans is a story of ideas that shine light into dark corners.